This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. We are back with another episode of A Good Cry, and it's me, Michael Cruz Kane, your host with the most ways to contact a ghost. That's not true. I just rhymed and I started saying it, and maybe we will edit that part out. How you doing? Thanks for listening. I appreciate all your messages. I know I haven't gotten back to everybody yet, but as I say every episode, I will. I promise I am getting to you. Also, let me say, and this is a little bit out of order, usually I do the grief thoughts first, but I just can't help but tell you how excited I am for you all to hear this episode today with Caitlin Doty, who is not like other guests we've had. Typically, the guests we have are people who have experienced some kind of first-degree immediate tragedy. And Caitlin is actually a mortician and an advocate for something she calls death positivity. She has a funeral home in LA. She is around grief all the time. And so she and I have a talk that's a little bit different from any of the talks we've had before. I hope you will find it as fascinating as I did. And if you're interested in her, you can go check out. She's got a TED Talk you can look up. She's got a YouTube channel called Ask a Mortician, where she talks about composting people, how cremation works, all kinds of fascinating things. And let me say this also, here's my grief thought. Again, a little out of order. I'm off the template because I'm so hyped about today's episode. Question for you, the listeners. What to you would be the best case funeral? It's a question I pose to Caitlin. Like, what could the best possible funeral be for you? You die. Do you want everybody to be real sad? A lot of sadness, everybody quiet, your body's in a casket already underground. Or maybe you want noisemakers and you want party hats and you want champagne and people weekends at Bernie-ing your body all over the room. What is it to you? Message me at agoodcry@theradiopoint.com. That's my email address, or you can DM me on Instagram or Twitter. I want to know, and I'll talk about it in the intro to the next episode. This episode is really fun. And we hope to do more episodes that change the paradigm of this podcast to give us not only people who have experienced grief in the direct way that all our previous guests have, but also people like Caitlin who are in their own ways experts on the subject. You're the best. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoy this ep as much as I enjoyed making it. And here it comes. Hello, Caitlin, and welcome to the podcast. Here we are. We're doing it.
Thank you for having me. We are doing it.
How are you doing? Are you doing all right today?
I'm doing okay.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I wanted to say, the question we start the podcast off with is, how would you describe your relationship to grief?
This is a good question for me and all of us, obviously, which is why you ask it.
Okay.
I think that my work has actually, I wouldn't say been criticized, but sort of the dialogue has been started about, is my work enough about grief? Do I talk about grief enough in my work? Because I tend to focus on the dead body. I'm really a corpse gal, if you will.
Sure, sure.
And I am interested in the dead body and how culture treats the dead body and how families treat the dead body and how the funeral industry treats the dead body. But for me, it really is all about grief, because the reason that I want families to spend time with their dead is because I think it gives you access to grief in a way that our modern industrialized funeral industry doesn't really set us up that well for. And I want people to be able to feel all the feelings of grief and get into the muck with their grief. So my relationship with grief is really, I say I wear corpse-colored glasses, but I really do see are the future of death and our access to grief as being a return to spending time with our dead and being present with dead bodies. So that is what I would say my relationship with grief is.
You're the first self-described corpse gal that I've had on the podcast. I also think maybe that I've ever met.
I hope so. Yeah. I'd have to talk to that other person and we'll have to do lunch if there was.
You talked about it in relationship to your work, but can you describe your work to the listeners? Because you're usually the people we have on the podcast are people who have had some kind of tremendous experience with grief of their own, but your situation and occupation is different from that.
It is, although I say that I do have a sort of my superhero origin story is rooted in grief in a lot of ways. When I was very young, I was about 8 years old, I was at my local shopping mall at Halloween time, and there was a young child that fell from the high balcony in the mall and fell to the ground below, and I heard the thud of the child falling, and it was incredibly difficult for me, the aftermath of that. I never really found out exactly what happened to the child, although all signs pointed to nothing particularly good. And I don't think that I had, my parents were incredibly supportive and loving, but I don't think they knew how much I was mulling it over in my head constantly and how afraid of death and how terrified of death I became after that experience. And how I was always worried that my parents were going to die or my friends were going to die or that my dog was going to die. And I think in a lot of ways, the career path that I ultimately end up taking, which was getting a job at a crematory when I was 23 years old and haven't left the funeral industry since then, to the point that I now own a funeral home and I do this work to kind of reform the industry that I'm in, does really come from that first experience with death and noticing what I'm sure you've noticed, which is that culture, our culture in the West, doesn't do a fantastic job of supporting grievers or open talk about death in any of its forms. And so I think that's how, you know, and I don't really, it's hard to define that because was that my personal grief? Can we say that I was grieving that child when I didn't know that child? And maybe I was grieving that child, but probably more what I was doing at age 8 was grieving my own sense of safety and grieving a sense of, you know, a world, like my world was different from the afternoon of that day to the evening of that day.
That makes a lot of sense to me. That idea of like grief, not for like a loss that you yourself feel acutely in terms of your relationship to this person, but like a perception of the world that has just passed away.
Right. And I think, I mean, that's kind of what we've been through with the pandemic, right? Is this sense of like, even if people are like, why do I have any reason to feel depressed or feel anxious right now? Nobody I know actually died of COVID. It's like, well, but you're also grieving the loss of the life that you thought you knew and what you thought you were working towards.
Yeah.
And all of that is just like, poof, gone now. And that's a valid form of grieving.
Yeah. Did your parents, when you had that experience in the mall and you were a kid, do you remember at all how your parents tried to help you process that? Or if they like, you know, or if they tried to help you process it?
They didn't. I think looking back on it, they were incredibly loving, and when it first happened, like the next morning, they tried to take me out for pancakes and kind of talk to me about it. But I think a lot of kids do this. I really subsumed it into my body and did not want to talk openly about it. And it's not like they didn't make me feel safe. I just kind of knew. I knew even at that young age, which I think a lot of people do, is like, that's not the vibe, kid. Like, nobody wants, that's not the vibe of the room right now. That's not what we're doing. Nobody wants to hear about how you're still having nightmares about this 4 months later, 5 months later. That's just not,
right.
brings it down.
The other kids want to play tag. They don't want to get involved in this.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, we want to watch this, like, we want to watch My Little Pony. We don't want to hear about your, like, a horror of the human condition.
I mean, I think that is a thing. I guess I've never really thought about this. The first moment I became aware as a child that like death exists. I think of the idea of like crumpling a piece of paper for the first time and then unfolding it and like this will never be flat again. Like that idea all the time. But I don't really know when I first felt that. I remember having, even like people who died when I was a kid in my family, you know, grandparents or people, it didn't impress, the idea of their death had made no impression on me because it felt like it's happening in another world. It's not happening to me. Something happened to these people, but not to me. But I could see, like, if it happened literally, like, right next to you in a mall, that it would be a very different experience.
No, I think that's a really interesting truth, because what we come to, and I'd be interested in knowing if your son's death was kind of your first existential exposure to this, because we have a lot of people now, because we no longer live 150 years ago, when in a normal family, 2 out of 5 children would survive.
Yeah.
You know, that was just the norm. And so death was always around you and was always a possibility. And that's really been eliminated in a lot of ways, especially for people in our class and in our place in the world. And so you do have people who get to a certain age, never really having even been to a funeral or never having experienced the existential threat of how real and how devastating death can be.
Yeah, I think, I mean, for me, it certainly was the first time that someone that I knew died that I felt the impact of it. Like, I mean, not good friends, but like a coworker of mine died, and I remember he was hit by a car. And I remember my other coworkers being understandably like really distressed by it. And my sort of logical brain was like, I mean, that's life, man. People are going to die. Like, that is what it is. And I remember like seeing them grieve and being like, I don't understand why I'm not as sad about this as these people are. I still don't fully have a reason for that. But when my son died, that was for sure, That was the doors being thrown open to the concept of grief in a way that I hadn't, you know, been aware of it before.
Right, which you wouldn't, you know, as I said, even 150, 200 years ago, you really wouldn't have been allowed to get to that age.
Right.
That you were without having to confront that.
Yeah, and I think it's also because, this is like maybe a sudden awareness I'm having of my own egomania, but also because that one was going to change my life. So, like, I mean, you know, it's definitely selfish, but it's like these other people, all the, like, these satellites to my own very solipsistic view of the universe, those people dying, I can keep going the way that I was going. This happening, it's like, wait, the way I was going doesn't even exist. There is no way.
Right. No, I think that's actually very common. And one of the things that when I encourage people just to sit with their dead when someone has died, I was once speaking to a rabbi about it, which sounds very, now I sound like I'm telling very weighty wisdom here, but it sort of is. And what the rabbi brought up is he said that when you're with a dead body, it also unlocks this thing in you where you're able to grieve for people who have died previously that you were never really able to grieve for. Maybe because you hadn't had that kind of existential smashing open of, oh, this affects me, or it didn't really feel real because you were young, or whatever reason, whatever emotional reason or whatever grief blockage you may have experienced, it gives you this time to be in the presence of death. And you might be encouraged to be like, oh, crap. Like, I really do have these things that I maybe would have engaged in a different way or felt grief or felt sadness around and just didn't, but it's coming back to me now in a strange way. And something you probably hear all the time as you're starting to do more publicly do this work is the phrase grief waits, which in one hand is kind of, you know, a lot of grief stuff is a little corny, as we know, unfortunately.
Sure.
But I think that one is really true. And I like that it's also a little sinister.
Yeah.
Like, grief waits. Like, it's waiting around a dark corner for you. But it's true. There are so many things in our lives that just by repressing and not grieving and not feeling, it's not going to go away.
Right.
It'll come back.
It's inevitable.
Yeah. It's not. It's hiding somewhere in your psyche.
I wanted to talk about, you mentioned just now, the idea of sitting with a dead body. And I want to make it clear to the listeners that you don't mean that. That's not a metaphor. You're talking about actually sitting with a dead body.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah, it's definitely not a metaphor. To be clear, though, someone you know.
Right.
We're not just finding random dead bodies to sit with. It's not a kind of general practice. What it is, although that is, there is a kind of tradition of that, especially in Buddhism, of going to charnel grounds and watching the decomposing bodies. So there is, it's not like there's no history, wow, historical precedent for that. But what I'm talking about now is the idea that until the rise of the funeral industry, which is an industry in the 20th century, families just took care of their own dead. Families or people in your general area, your community, came together to take care of the body in the home. And what we now call a home funeral was really just a funeral. Obviously, the funeral would take place in the home. And so for really tens of thousands of years of human history, death was taken care of in the community. And it's a very recent development that the body care is outsourced to a third party that we pay to take care of our dead and then kind of present it back to us and sell it as a product back to us.
Is that something, this is pure speculation and very possibly wrong, but is that something that started with, like, you know, more aristocratic families, like being able to hire people to do that kind of work for you and then just filtering down to other people?
Yeah, there's kind of two-pronged, and I won't talk for 40 minutes about this. This is my, like, deepest thing that I want people to know, though, is that it was kind of, I'm going to keep it down to two things. One being that the men who started to embalm bodies during the Civil War to preserve bodies, chemically preserve bodies, to order to put them on the train and send them back up to the North. After the Civil War, their skills weren't really needed as much anymore. And so they really made a push to professionalize funeral directing and embalming and say you have to have certain skills in order to take care of the dead. And you have to have certain, you know, we're doctors and we need to be licensed and treated as such, which I would say, as my mother would say, is horse pucky, but there you go. And then the second element, exactly as you said, it did have a lot to do with class and this increasing desire with industrialization of, like, being a middle class person and wanting to be seen in a certain way and not wanting everybody to come to your home to visit a dead body, but to be able to go to a nice parlor where the body was presented and to have more trappings of a fancier funeral and material culture and all of that. So that's very true in a lot of ways. So I don't want to say it's just a, you know, predatory funeral industry. People did want it to, you know. But I think that over time through the 20th century and where we are now, there are a lot of people who do feel there is something missing from their funeral experience. And they do feel like there's something missing from their grieving experience with the way that more conventional funeral homes are set up. So when we say sitting with the body, it really is as simple as, okay, your mom died. She was on hospice care. She died in the home. The moment that she dies, she doesn't become radioactive. It's not an emergency. She's not decomposing. You don't need to call the funeral director and get her out of there right now. She can stay right there in her bed. You can fix her hair. You can put on her favorite sweater. You can play music that she liked. You can tell stories. We can go back to a way of just sitting with the dead. And I think when we do sit with the dead and have some active care of the dead, not only does it bring back some sense of ritual to death, which is hands-on and mental, but it also really gives this just awesome space to grieve and to kickstart that grieving process. Because what you hear a lot with people who are in mourning long-term is a sense of, they were there and then they were just gone. They just disappeared. Maybe they just were sent off to be cremated, or, you know, I never saw them again. And I feel complicated about this. And it just is a way, it doesn't mean that, like, you have one, you know, 6-hour session sitting with a body and you come out and you're like, mom's dead, but whatever, I'm free.
I'm great now.
Obviously, you're still on your whole grief journey. But I would really argue that it kickstarts it and gives you, it allows you to plunge into the reality of the death headfirst and be with it. And people who really do that and come and sit with the body and have that unmediated contact over a period of time tend to feel really positive about it. I rarely, if ever, get feedback that it was horrifying and I couldn't sit with mother as she grew cold and, you know, her gnarled body. You just don't hear that. You hear about warmth and you hear about love and you hear about a positive start to their grieving process.
I think that's so interesting because when you say the phrase plunge into the reality of the death, my visceral reaction is puke. But there's also a part, but I know that's because I think of death as like a certain thing. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like I've been conditioned my entire life to sort of believe that it doesn't exist or affect me. And then having it like the reality of it thrust upon me is very jarring, as opposed to just thinking, I think of myself as separate from it, as a thing that, that exists outside of me and far away, until the death of my son, when it's like, oh no, this is not only here, but it's every place for all time. And most people, I've said this on this podcast before, but most people are dead. Death is like, and the rest of us are just, you know, pre-dead. And having some like real thought about that is not something I would have ever done and didn't really do even in the, you know, time immediately after my son's death. But I never did it before then. I never really thought to.
Well, something that I picked up on in your original thread about his death was you mentioned, and then he went to be cremated. What does that mean? What is that even, like, what is even going on with a cremation? And for me, a lot of my work is not only hanging out with the corpse, although that's probably the cornerstone, but it's also things like, you know, my entire first book was like, what happens at a crematory? What happens behind the scenes at a crematory? What's going on? And something that I have found is, yeah, it's obviously it's hard to engage with that kind of nitty-gritty knowledge of what is happening to a dead body. But I wouldn't, absolutely would have stopped doing this work. It would have been dead in the water, no pun intended, at the very beginning if the consistent feedback wasn't, actually, this is helpful. Actually, I feel better knowing the truth about this. And I feel like there's no bigger truth in all of humanity than a dead body. Because there's no bigger truth than not only is this person now dead and they you will not have a future, interact. You can have a future, of course, you know, depending on whether you feel like there's an afterlife or you're in continued conversation with mourning and the dead, of course there can be a future that way, but there's not a in this living realm future with this person. And you're going to die too. This is a reminder that death is real and you're going to die. And that's a reminder that we could all kind of use to be self-aware, complete people.
Yeah. I mean, there's no bigger truth than a dead body, like, hit me in my gut. Like, it, that is, I mean, it's so real. And I think it is, there's so many reasons I can think of that death is, that we want to keep death separate from ourselves because it gives us this sense of immortality. But I even think of like, this is maybe take a bridge too far, but even in like a capitalist society, to imagine the benefit to the upper classes of like, not reminding you that you are eventually going to die. Like, you could do this forever. I think if everyone was like, you know, I am actually going to be dead soon. Do I want to keep doing this thing I'm doing? I think it could change your worldview to have a more really like literally tactile experience with death.
Oh, that's not taking it too far at all. That's right on.
Okay, I'm not sure if it sounds like I just like smoked a bowl before this podcast.
No. Well, but that, I mean, that's kind of that, you know, not to, maybe this is taking it too far, but that's like also kind of the realm that it can get to, you know, that kind of like, maybe I sound high, but like I'm experiencing more expansive thoughts than I'm normally. And that's what I call it, like a liminal space. Like if you are allowed, and that's a big problem with grieving too, is like after the experience of a death, people need time to exist in that liminal space and have the intensity of feeling and like the stoner thoughts about what is life and what am I doing? You know, those are all very valid things that you need to experience after the death of someone really important to you. And the fact that we're like expected to go back to work after 2 days, like you want to talk about like capitalist nonsense, the fact that we are supposed to experience a death and then go right back to like production.
Yeah, I mean, that's something I think about all the time is the way when my son was dying and died, and after he died, going outside and being like, whatever, so you guys are all just keep doing, everyone just keeps doing what they were doing, and then I go back to work. The job that I had at the time was amazing. And they were like, basically, come back whenever you want to come back, come back. But even then, it's very, obviously destabilizing to try and walk back into the regular world
right
after you've been through something, after you've been through anything, but that in particular.
Well, it's also, and I think about this, it's like with, especially if a child dies, we almost are like, it's almost like harder. No one will ask you about it, but you get a little more time off work. You know, it's like this like terrible capitalist like bargain.
Trade-off.
Yeah. Yeah, like trade-off. Like if your husband dies, we're more willing to be like, because that's not as threatening to us somehow. We're more willing to be like, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry, Cheryl, but it is going to be 3 days. And after that, it's unpaid. And it will be vacation days.
Yeah, exactly. That's going to cut into your paid time off, unfortunately.
Right. And like a child is like, well, you know, obviously like a week, 2 weeks, but like when you come back, absolute crickets.
Yeah, when you come, we'll give you as much time as you want, but in exchange, never talk about this at the workplace.
Never, never. Just a sort of like sad sigh every time you walk by. Well, I mean, was that your experience? Like who do you feel spoke to you best in the weeks and months after?
Okay. So first of all, I should say, in spite of the jokes, my workplace at the time was great. The hardest thing was not people telling me not to talk about it, but more that like the number one thing for me was I didn't want to have to tell anybody. I wanted them to already know. Mm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because I could tell whenever I told someone that it was like punching them in the face. Like I had a friend of mine, it's not at work, but I had a friend of mine, you know, who saw me not long after the kids had been born, the twins had been born, who I saw on the way into rehearsal for some comedy thing. And he was like, hey man, so good to see you. How are the twins? And I'm like, oh fuck, dude, this sucks for you. This sucks so bad.
Yeah, I'm about to ruin your day.
Oh shit. One of them died, buddy. Now we gotta fucking go in here. It's not your fault. But like the act of telling people about it was hard because I knew how hard it was for them, because I know that up until, you know, a week before that, I was like them. If someone had told me their kid had died, I'd be like, dude, that sucks for you. I need to go sit in a room by myself and deal with this thing that happened to you. So the hardest part for me was seeing how hard it was for other people. I mean, let me not say that. That was not the hardest part. A hard part. A hard part of reintegrating was that it's like, you are my friend, or, you know, whatever level of relationship we have, I don't know how to interact with you without you knowing this thing about me. I can't listen to you tell me 20 stories about your kids, or have you tell me like, oh, and then she has twins. Can you imagine? I can't have you say that. So I want to help you by preloading your brain with the information that this has happened.
Right. Yeah. No, that's, yeah.
And that's part of like the social media aspect of it is like, I'm going to just put this out there so that every single person who knows me will know this. And then they don't have to do anything with it, but more just like, I don't want them to step on a landmine that they're not ready for.
No, that's what I was going to ask you, is that I wonder if, you know, like I said, 150 years ago, everybody lived and died more in communities. So it would probably be much easier for everyone very quickly in the community to know where everyone stood with life and death. And then we had this big gap in the industrialized world in the 20th century. And I wonder if social media has actually kind of helped that in a weird way, in the sense that you now can announce that and have as opposed to having to like see everyone at comedy shows for the next 6 months and play the Grim Reaper. Like if they follow you on Instagram or Twitter, they would know, or Facebook, that this had happened. Like I wonder if that's actually sort of a strange benefit in not having to have the conversation again and again.
I mean, it helped me. I don't want to encourage necessarily everyone to tweet about their tragedies, but for me, like the idea of holding in a secret, even though it's not like I didn't do something bad, still, it makes me feel bad. Mm. You know, like even like whatever little things that I've like told someone that they looked good and I really don't think they look good. Even those like little things that I feel them like burrowing tiny little holes. This was huge. This was like, there's a crater here. I would need to get this out so that I can not have to live with the daily anxiety of you finding out about this during our conversation.
And having to be having to play the Grim Reaper to their sense of the world.
Exactly. Because also I was going to tell them. It's not like I wasn't going to hide it. And if it came up in any way, I was going to say it. But It's just, it's tricky to negotiate that because of the way that we think about death, I think, which is why I'm so fascinated by your work.
Well, I think that's something that being around death a lot, as I am, when somebody, like if we didn't know each other and you, or, you know, we hadn't seen each other in a while, and obviously I didn't know the fact that your son had died. If you told me he died, I would hopefully be able to instantly go, oh shit, I'm so sorry, I had no idea, and then stay with you and continue, and you wouldn't have to see me like spiral off, like behind my eyes, like spiral off into processing this, because I've been around death so much, I'm able to just stay with you.
Yeah.
And obviously let you say more if you need to, but that is a skill that like only people like me are lucky enough to have, because most people aren't around death in that way.
Yeah. I think that there really are, I mean, the two kinds of people that I would think would be prepared for that are people who are in your line of work, which means confronting death on the daily, or people who have suffered. And so like when I see or someone tells me offhandedly about something, or you know, maybe not even offhandedly, maybe it's a centerpiece of the conversation about some tragedy in their life, obviously I feel for them, but there's another part of me that's like, oh, I know you now in a way I didn't know you, in a way I couldn't have known you before. And like having those conversations like these with those people.
Right. And obviously it shows you that that kind of conversation is probably safe with that person.
Yeah.
But also I think we have a real misconception about those hard conversations as like necessitating a baroque response, or that like the grieving itself was incredibly baroque in the sense of like, oh, I'm so displeased to hear of this tragedy that has befallen your family. Like as if your grieving process looked like you like weeping over the grave of your son with your hand on your forehead.
Right.
You know, as opposed to just like raw, real shit dragging through the mud over a period of months and years, which is much with ups and downs and ins and outs, which is much more the reality of grief, which is why it, especially in our modern world, seems to necessitate more of a reaction of just like, ah, shit, man. Like, woof, that sounds like the worst thing.
Yeah, and I think that is... That
sucks for your life, man, as opposed to like, oh, my dearest, I had no sense of this tragedy. That, you know what I'm saying? Like,
yes, totally. As opposed to, I think people do feel pressure to be like, well, as Edna St. Vincent Millay once said, and you're like, you don't have to. It's fine if you can't pull the perfect quote right now. And it is, I really feel relieved when people are like, oh, fuck, that's so horrible. It's like, okay, because then we exist in reality together. And I can tell that's a person trying to just process what is real about that. And also, I feel like I don't begrudge any, no one has ever said a mean thing or the wrong thing. And I understand why people spiral out when I talk about this kind of stuff. I don't hold that against anybody.
Oh, yeah.
But there are people who you can tell are prepared for the conversation and other people who are not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they say, and I agree with you. I think it's actually a really useful point to because we do kind of prioritize like lists of wrong things that people say, yeah. You know, like all the things that grievers do not want to hear from your smug, not grieving face. You know, we do tend to like to see it that way. But I like that you say that no one ever did anything wrong specifically. But I do think that like there is this sense of like, the best response is often just like, fuck, man.
Yeah.
Like, ooh, that's, I mean, my favorite response is just like, that sucks so much.
Yes.
I'm so sorry. Like, I can't even, wow.
Yes, I agree. I think it's hard to do better than that. Like, sorry for your loss is really like the best it can be. There's not much more. I've yet to encounter a response to hearing of the story of my son and have been like, whew, man, what Shelley just said to me absolutely knocked it out of the park.
Yeah, cracked open the egg of my grief and my soul, and like truths I didn't know poured out when she told me about the death of her own dog, you know. It just doesn't.
Yeah, exactly.
Probably doesn't work that way.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, wait. But what has happened now, Caitlin, is you have skillfully started interviewing me, and I wanted to ask you more. I want to ask more about your work because what you do is incredible. So can you talk? You have a funeral home in LA, is that right?
Yeah. So my approach to my advocacy is multi-pronged. And what I do is I do own a small funeral home in Los Angeles, and it does focus on low prices, transparency, and family-led death care. So we want you to come and be with the dead body and experience the dead body. We also have a nonprofit called the Order of the Good Death, and that's if you want any more information about this, if you want information on new ways to see death, like human composting or aquamation or these new technologies or even green burial, that's a really good resource.
Those are things that turn the body into soil?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the first one, human composting, turns the body into soil. Aquamation is similar to cremation, but it's done with high heat water instead of flame. And then green burial is just a hole in the ground and a body placed in the hole and allowed to decompose into the soil. And so those all happen at the Order of the Good Death. And then I write books. I have a YouTube series called Ask a Mortician. And all of these things kind of do the same thing, which is try and help people not only talk about death, but also really talk about the funeral industry that we have now and ways that it can be better.
And what are some of those ways?
Some of those ways are, well, when these, I mentioned this earlier, but when death became professionalized in the early 20th century, it really set up this barrier to, like, here are these trained people who are allowed to touch the dead body and handle the dead body, and then it's everyone else. It's the masses of people who don't know how dangerous the dead body can be. The reality is there is absolutely no evidence that the dead body is dangerous in any way. The bacteria that causes decomposition is not the same bacteria that causes disease. There are a few small situations like avian bird flu or Ebola where a body might still be contagious, but you would have had to have died
from bird flu. It's not like you're dead and now you have bird flu.
Yes, exactly. No one's developing postmortem Ebola. Your grandmother you thought had ovarian cancer. No. It's much worse. So you really are always safe to be around the dead body and being present with the dead body. And so that's one thing that I want. I'd much rather funeral directors, because there is a lot of bureaucracy when you die. And there is, in this world, a need for the funeral system and funeral directors. But they should really be there as support to the family. The family are the experts on the person who died. The funeral director is not the expert on the dead body, is my position on this. There also needs to be more. Funerals are too expensive. I think that's not a revelation for anyone. You shouldn't have to go into debt or do a GoFundMe when someone dies. You should just have, there's absolutely no federal government help for death at all. There's actually COVID in the pandemic, there's been, the federal government will, you know, pay for your funeral if you died of COVID. And that's the first federal help we've seen for death.
Is that unusual, Caitlin? Do other countries have funeral support from the government?
It is unusual. Yes, absolutely. So in some countries, death is handled by the government primarily, and funeral homes and cemeteries are run by the government, and then some are private. In a lot of places, there is government help financially for death. In some states, there is help financially for death, but it often is kind of a process where you have to prostrate yourself before them to, like, just show them how poor you are. before you can get help. And that's unacceptable. There are a lot of laws that prevent certain things from happening. One of my favorite, I say favorite with a, you know, big scare quotes around it, is something called a ready to embalm law. What ready to embalm laws mean is that your funeral home in, I believe it's 39 states, is that your funeral home has to be ready to embalm at any time, ready to chemically embalm the corpse, even though so many cultures and communities do not require, or in fact say you cannot embalm the dead. So in order to open a funeral home, you would have to have a whole embalming room and an embalmer on staff, even if you're a Jewish funeral home or a Muslim funeral home. Or if you're a green funeral home like mine that doesn't really offer embalming, you'd have to have these. And these are all things that kind of protect the industry as it started in the 20th century. But people don't necessarily want those things anymore. And statistics show that people want different things when they die. And so that's a lot of the work we're doing too, and the work to legalize things like aquamation and human composting that align maybe more with values that people have.
Because those things, I feel like human composting is either legal, I want to say, in Colorado. I don't know how many other states it's legal
And Washington. Washington was the first state. Gotcha. And so there are bills, I believe now in Massachusetts. There was one in California that we were working really hard on, but did not go through because Gavin Newsom, the governor, was being recalled, and they didn't want him to have to vote on psychedelics and human composting.
Right. Politics.
So even though the bill made it all the way through, it got cut off at the knees at the last minute. So during the recall, Governor Gavi would not have to weigh in on that.
Oy. Yeah, I mean, for me, for my son's funeral, I have no recollection of how we ended up at the place we ended up at. I barely remember the decision to cremate him. It just kind of like, we were in a haze. He died in a hospital, so I'm sure the hospital was like, well, we know this place. And we just kind of like went through the, like, just, it's like jumping on a water slide and now you're in the water. You're like, I don't know what happened between there and here, but this is where I am. And the guys who ran the funeral, as far as I recall, were nice. And we had a priest that we'd never seen or heard of before or since who, you know, said some Bible platitudes or whatever. And a bunch of lovely people were there and everything was nice, but I have no, it didn't feel like an experience that belonged to us specifically. It felt like a thing that we were doing here. And then we got another one of these at 4. It felt like more like that kind of vibe. No discredit to them. I'm sure they do a great job.
Well, you know, that's actually, I think that's an interesting point, is that you really have, there's a couple funeral experiences you can have now. There's the experience that would be the ideal, that is like an embodied journey where you really do, not that you have to remember every part of it, but that you know that actual healing happens around it, and that something that something happens there that is meaningful or powerful. And then you have what you went through, which, you know, to its credit, at least you just slid on through and it didn't traumatize you.
Yes,
in some other way, because that's the third type of the funeral, is that you go to a funeral home and things happen that make it harder to grieve and make it harder to have a good grief experience because, you know, somebody does something that hurts that process. And so of the three, you know, I guess, on one hand, I can hear that story, and I can wish there was more there for you just from the death experience, because I just know how powerful it can be. But at the same time, like, you know, with a death that's so intense and so tragic, like the one that you experienced, sometimes just getting through and not having it do any damage is a positive outcome.
Right. That's a success.
Yeah.
So in terms of funerals, what would be, in your mind, Caitlin, like, what's like the, either one that you've been to or one that you imagine, what is like the best bomb-ass funeral that you're like, we fucking crushed this shit?
Yeah, my favorite funeral. Well, keep in mind that this is from my perception as like a non-religious white person.
Sure,
so
sure,
this
sure,
is
sure,
like,
sure.
You know, I don't have a specific like cultural viewpoint.
Yes. Not requiring you to speak for everybody. Just
right. Okay. Thank you. Because sometimes you feel like you do, right? But like thank you for just, yes. I'll just speak for me alone here. I think, well, let's just kill me off. Let's say that I die.
Okay.
I think that what I would like most is for a, for my body to be just laid out and people like no embalming, no anything, just in my living room. And people who loved me can come by. People who really loved me or who are very close to me, you know, can spend some time alone if they want, or just everybody, like, just leave me there till everyone's done.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, leave me there until enough people feel like something has shifted inside of them and that they've had the right amount of time with me. And you really, that is a feedback that I get a lot, is that, like, after a certain point, something does shift in people. They go, oh, wait a second, like, I think I can call the funeral home. I think this is over now. And so your body will kind of tell you that in an interesting way. So that's what I want to happen there. My real dream for my body is to be eaten by animals, to be laid out to be eaten by animals, because I feel like I'm a vegetarian now, but for many years I ate animals and I had my turn with them, and now they should have their turn with me because I am an animal. That is not legal. You could do it with at like a body farm or one of those university locations where you donate your body to science and they lay you out to be tested.
That's a thing that you can do that, and then animals will eat your dead body?
That is a thing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Holy shit, dog.
Yep. They're called human decomposition facilities.
That's it. I mean, that's intense. I love it. I never would have thought of that. That's not an answer. If I had to guess 100 answers to the question I asked you, I would never have thought, oh, and then I would like to be eaten by animals.
Yeah, well, it's a surprise. So, I mean, look them up. Body farms is kind of the, like, colloquial name for them, but they're called, like, human decomposition facilities, which are basically, okay, they're usually associated with a university, and they're there for a lot of reasons. They're there to either test, you know, if I put a body in this kind of polyester suit and they're in a grave that's 2 feet deep, what happens to their body? When is their insect life? What's happening? And that helps solve crimes. It's how we know most of what we know about forensics is programs like this.
Cool.
So true crime lovers, I may have the body disposition for you. And it also, you know, there are systems where students can come in and when they can process the body like they would a crime scene. So there's all sorts of interesting things that your body might be used for. I am hoping eventually to have places where it doesn't even have to be for science. It can just be like, I want to be eaten by vultures, or I want to be eaten by really whatever scavenger animal is available to consume me and would like to.
Are you saying that because there are, in your experience, a lot of people who have the desire to be consumed by animals after they die? Or you're just saying, like, if this started happening, it would be more popular?
I think it would. I think that of all of my kind of, like, cornerstone advocacy points, this is the one that people, when I say it and I say it emphatically, people nod their head and they get it, but I haven't gotten a lot of traction to people being like, yes, I'm with you and we'll make it happen, like, whatever it takes.
Right.
You know, so I think I'm somewhat, although this does happen in other countries. This happens in Tibet. This happens in Zoroastrian religions. Like, this is a thing that's still actively happening, where people, vultures primarily, eat the dead body. So it's not without precedent.
And is that done through is there some kind of intermediate step where it passes through a handler of some kind?
Yes, yeah. In Tibet, so the reason that it happens in Tibet is it's so high up in the mountains that they don't grow enough trees for big cremation pyres, and the ground is so frozen that hard to get into for a burial. So there is a kind of like a funeral director sort of position where they kind of start it for you. They do like cuts and fillets and some grinding of your bones to really prepare you to be laid out for vultures for easy consumption. And then you see there's footage of this online. You can see it's just absolutely gorgeous to me. But these huge, and vultures that are like way, way bigger than you see at the side of the road here, you know, in the US, but just like massive vultures swoop down and just that's called the sky burial because they're taking you up to the sky in their stomachs and consuming you.
Wow.
And I love that option. I think it's absolutely beautiful.
It doesn't seem that far gone from, I keep interrupting you, I'm so sorry. It doesn't seem that far gone, sort of like philosophically, from the human compost.
No.
Like the things seem related to each other.
Absolutely. And I think that most of my sense of all of these options is to, it's about bodily, because so much about our traditional funeral industry in the United States especially is about preservation, is about desperate preservation. It's about chemically embalming the body. It's about putting it in a sealed metal casket. It's about then putting it in a concrete vault below the ground. So many layers of protection and preservation for the body. It's not ashes to ashes. You're not coming anywhere near the dirt around you if you're buried in a cemetery. And for me, that is not a realistic understanding of the human body in an organic life cycle. And so all of these options, whether it's you're turning into soil or you're just rotting in the ground or you're being taken apart by animals, it's a desire to return us to an understanding of us as animals and part of this cycle, and that our atoms don't belong to us in a super special human way.
That's fascinating. I never really even thought about that, but how separate the idea of being in a coffin or being in an urn is, like, you don't return to the earth really exactly. You're kept separate.
No.
Okay, so wait, we've got people hanging with your body until they feel ready.
Mm-hmm.
We got eaten possibly by vultures or some other scavenger animal.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also asking about, we got a band? Are people giving speeches at the funeral? What are we doing at Caitlin's funeral?
You know, this is interesting, and that's a very good question.
Thank you.
I've never really been one, or it's a good pushback, because I've never really been one to think about what song I wanted played.
Okay.
Or what, like, mood I want everyone in, or like what funny costumes I want them wearing. And I know that's extremely helpful for a lot of people. And actually, like, I think millennials have really gotten into funeral planning because there is a kind of individualism there that's very important. And part of it, though, I think maybe because for me is that I already have to be online and I already have to kind of make that performance.
Mm-hmm.
In a strange way, like a performance of self. And so if I die, like, my interest is just in rotting.
You did it. I'm done.
Yeah, like, I'm done. Like, let me rot. Let the animals tear at my flesh. Goodbye, everyone. And, like, you know, maybe I'll get a nice obit somewhere online. But it's that the idea of my, as far as how my family grieves or what they do in that sense, that I'm happy to let them decide on. You know?
Yeah. I'm like a whore for attention even when I'm dead. I want a lot of people there.
Mm-hmm.
Let's do a big party. I don't know. Let's get the Beatles. I don't know who we're going to get, but somebody big.
The Beatles, I think, would be great.
I think they would be good. I think they'd be good.
Do you think about the body itself ever?
Like my son's body?
No, your body. Your physical body.
I don't really think about, I mean, I don't think... Well, I guess I don't know how specifically you mean that. I think about becoming a fat piece of shit. Is that what you're talking about?
No. I mean, like, what you would want done with it.
I think...
After the party, post-party, post-death party.
I think I could see... I think, like, returning to the earth in some way, like being turned into soil or something, but I'm kind of free-balling it right now, Caitlin. I've just said that off the top of my head, but it sounds appealing to me.
Well, think about it. Yeah.
The idea of being in a coffin is not, I don't think, is what I would want, but mostly sort of related to what you were saying about how your family would decide sort of what happened. To me, it's like whatever's easiest for y'all. I mean, I think if I could pick anything, it would be turn me into soil and then plant a tree in me or whatever. But if that's a pain in the ass, do whatever the fuck is easiest for you guys. I'm dead. So whatever you want is good by me.
Well, I think it's a good mix there, because families I have found do want the dead person to have had an opinion. Like it really does make, you know, kids come in all the time to the funeral home and they say, you know, mom really wanted, like, we do green burials out at Joshua Tree at a at a kind of desert cemetery with the real Joshua trees and everything. It's quite lovely. And if they say, Mom chose that, and that's really what she wanted.
Okay.
You know, that makes them feel good. Or Dad always said cremation was it for him. He didn't want to pay a ton of money. This is what it, like, it makes your survivors feel good to have some sort of mandate to carry on.
Okay, duly noted.
And I understand what you mean about, like, if it's too hard, let him off the hook and say, like, you know, or cremate me.
Right.
You know, I think that's an important thing, to not give them too many tasks. But, like, a couple tasks is always nice for people grieving.
Yeah, I guess, because it, like, helps sort of kickstart the ritual of it, the, like, mm-hmm. something is happening here idea.
Right.
Being around grief as much as you must be, are there moments that you remember in, like, that exposure that have changed the way you look at death or changed the way you think of yourself?
I think it's more that I have come to support, especially in people in my position, support sympathy over empathy, especially in some sort of professional capacity.
Now, Caitlin, I know exactly what you mean by that, but just pretend I didn't.
Yes. I'm going to continue my explanation of this.
Okay, great.
And what I mean by that is that sympathy, there's a difference between how involved you are with the other person's grief. And empathy, to me, means that you're in it with them. Maybe not completely, but you're like, oh, your son died. When you tell me that your son died, and maybe this is what I've learned to do as a professional, when you tell me that your son died, I feel profound sympathy for you. I feel terrible for you. I can't even understand it. I can't imagine it. But I don't think it's helpful for you to have me get into it with you, or to have it be I spiral off on my own feelings about, like, what if my child someday should die? What does this mean for me? Da, da, da. That's empathy is getting yourself a little too involved in my definition of it.
Gotcha.
And I don't think as a professional that's particularly healthy, because what you want me to do is, yeah, is to sympathize, but you really want me to just help you get from point A to point B. You want me to hold the space for you. You want me to take care of all the bureaucracy that you don't need to deal with at all, and to support you in that way, but you don't need me weeping with you. You have so many people weeping with you. You don't need a random lady at the funeral home weeping with you.
Right.
And so much of what we sometimes talk about in the funeral home, or sort of, I mean, think almost a knock on funeral directors, is like a fake sympathy. And I moved away from, like, I don't even do fake sympathy. If I have a real sympathetic thing to say, I'll say it. I don't dive into empathy, and I try not to. That doesn't mean I'm cold. It just means that you don't need me going on your grief journey with you, as sad as it is. You need my competence and my directness and my support. And that's how I think I've come to best live with the grief I see and feel.
Just to hear you describe that, it sounds like there's a lot of conscious effort put into the way you respond. And I wonder if that isn't hard. That sounds like it can be. You must be exposed to grief a lot, and having to sort of, you know, modulate your response in a way that you feel appropriate. Is that difficult, or do you find it like, maybe it's, you know, maybe it's not. Maybe it feels like a privilege all the time or whatever, but I could see that being very taxing.
Well, I think actually having so many things, I think if you are just a funeral director and you're there's obviously a lot of respect, and I did for many years, I was just a funeral director, like day in, day out, you do that work. There's a really high burnout rate in the funeral industry, because yeah, that's a hard thing to do every day for sure. No matter how good you are at modulating these things, like, it wears you down to see people at their rawest type of grief, and it can't help but affect you. But I'm in a situation now where I own a funeral home, but I have two funeral directors who work there actually, and a co-owner. I have lots of, I have my nonprofit, but I am not answering all the emails every day that come in. There are people. So I am now at a place where I do have a lot of privilege to kind of float above it, because I don't have, I've actually gotten, had to make the effort to get to a place in my advocacy in order to continue to do my advocacy where every day is not somebody bringing their grief to me.
Right.
And saying like, hello, here it is. And that doesn't mean like, and I have sympathy, like really genuine sympathy for every single one of those people. But it's true that if your job is people bringing you the worst story of their entire life every day, that can be hard to continue to do that work. And actually I'm not to interview you, but I do actually have that question for you too. Do you feel like since you've become more public about this and you've started doing this podcast and everything, has it become difficult for you to hear people wanting to share their stories and come to you with them?
Yeah, it hasn't yet. And I say yet only because I have friends who have done comedy or whatever else on the subject of some kind of something sad, depression, suicide, drug overdose, whatever. And a lot of them have been like, I mean, hey man, for me, it was pretty overwhelming. I haven't reached that point yet. I think a thing that I do have to be mindful of is that I don't receive someone's story and take it on as I have to turn this into something that makes them happy now. And as long as I don't do that, and I can just be as, just try and be real with it of, you know, like you said, like, oh, that's fucking terrible. That story, that is so awful. And thank you for sharing with me and feel the privilege of having that connection with somebody. I still am in that area and I hope that I'll stay there, but I could definitely see it being a thing where, you know, the 700th email you get about something really fucking terrible happening, being like, I think I got to stop answering these emails for like a week and then maybe I'll check in again.
Yeah, no, that's really like the experience. And I hope that you find that place for you, because I think that I'm glad that you're doing this. And I think it's a really important thing that you're doing. But I hope that you protect your ability to do this long term.
Thank you for saying that. I appreciate that. Okay, here's a question that we normally end with, and even though your story is different than other people we've had, I do wonder, we normally ask when we're talking about someone who's died, where you imagine this person being now, but I guess the question for you would be slightly different, but when you think of the dead, what do you think becomes of them?
Yeah, the way that I think about it, and I tend to, it's interesting, I'm glad you asked it that way, because when I tend to think about the dead or the experience of dying or what happens at that moment or where they go, I often think of myself. And I don't usually think of like, this is what happened to people I know who died. Like, I almost don't want to put my opinion on them. Right. I'm like, oh, maybe they went to heaven, you know, but I'll tell you what I'm going to do, which is this. But what I think about for myself is I really do think that death is, the way I have it as a metaphor, is one of those like film projectors that when it ends and the film runs out and it's just kind of flapping that white thing. That is kind of how I see death. I see is that there used to be a narrative running through your head or stories running through your head, and then it ends and then nothing ever comes up again. It flaps white. And it is a nothingness. I think people kind of take that as like, oh, you believe in the void of nothingness. And I guess that's true, but I don't find that nihilistic at all. I find that very comforting.
Right.
I think living can be hard and there's a lot going on. And I see it as like a beautiful permanent rest that we get after a life well lived.
Have you ever taken a nap? Naps are so good. It's like that.
Yeah, naps rule. And for me, my real sense of immortality comes from the idea of myself as an organic bit of material. So when I think of my dead body either being eaten by animals or becoming a tree, that's my immortality. Is that what, you know, it's physical immortality as opposed to metaphysical immortality.
Got it. That's beautiful. So yeah, so it's like, it's not necessarily the sense that you become another being, but that you like literally continue to exist as molecules that are on the earth.
Exactly.
I love that. Caitlin, thanks so much for doing this. It was a great honor and privilege.
Thank you for having me. This was a great conversation.
This is another episode of A Good Cry. Thanks for listening, and I hope it helps. Hey, buds. Michael Cruz Kane here again at the end of the episode to exhort, plead, cajole, beg, gently suggest that you subscribe to this podcast if you haven't, that you rate it, and that you give us a review that is 5 stars, or see if you can find a way to give a 6-star review. Do your best. But I'd love it if you would. It helps the pod immensely, helps people listen to us, helps us get sponsors, et cetera, et cetera. And thanks again, and I won't bother you anymore, I swear, probably. Bye. A Good Cry is produced by Radio Point and HeadGum, with executive producers Alex Bach, Sabrina Fonfetter, Richard Corson, Daniel Powell, and Houston Snyder. Recorded, edited, and mixed by Bree Mattan.
That was a HeadGum podcast.